Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I'm an SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us. We have TalkCast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. And if you want to participate on the web, just go to the twitch.tv website. Just go to twitch.tv/SFU on call and you will find us there. That's where we do the broadcasting of this co-broadcasting, because I do on talk show also, but most people are over on Twitch. So go to twitch.tv/SFU on call and join the chat room there, and you'll see my lovely face. And of course, you will hear the live broadcast of this show. And if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, you'll follow me on Twitter. That's also sfuoncall. And if you want to follow my personal account, because I'm so great, you can that's PaulFranz. That's Paul Franz. PaulFranz. There's no T in that at all. Just a reminder that I am very much an ardent Catholic. I love my O's, and I also love tech. So any of those bother you, don't follow me. Go O's. And of course, the lovely TalkCast gets turned to podcasts available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Not much going on at A to B this week, though I was looking forward to seeing Caps Log number 52 on the e-tailers, but they're not quite there yet. You know, they just did 51 last week. Hopefully we'll get one this week, or possibly next week. We'll get 52, which should be totally awesome. But obviously, I don't expect 54 until 55 is out the door, which is going to be interesting, because he'll probably have me writing up an article for that. Now, obviously, just a reminder that there are some free stuff from ADB at StarfleetGames.com. One of those things, of course, is First Missions. That's the Federation Commander. It's an introductory kind of game. It's based on the FedCom rules, so it lets you introduce into that gaming system. It has some of the rules, not all the rules, but some of the rules. Gives you an idea of how the system works. And if you like it, then you can buy the Federation Commander rules, which won't cost much. Obviously, when it comes to the Federation Commander stuff, the one thing you need is you're going to need those cards. And those cards, they're not expensive, but if you're anything like some of the card collectors of the past, yeah, those can get kind of expensive after a while. But, you know, hey, the idea is to get the ships that you want, you know, and enjoy them as you play them. Also, of course, you can get the free cadet training manual from the e-tailers, and that will allow you to introduce you into the Starfleet battles, which is a little more complicated than Federation Commander, but in my mind, I think it's more "quote unquote" realistic because of the details that are in Starfleet Battles versus some of the details that are kind of left off the board with Federation Commander. Continuing on to the SFB Online tournaments, we have the Sapphire Star 12 tournament coming up very, very soon. I just opened up the topic, and so I'm expecting to see people signing up for that tournament starting this week. When it comes to libraries, neither one has seen any action this week, neither the SFB or the FedCom library. And with that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one of the old friends, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, I've got Kitten here. We've got Doug, and we got Gary. Gary, how you doing?
Not too bad. How's everything?
Good. Doing good. I'm not sure how long I'll be holding this little kitten here, who's a numbnut. Yes, you are. And Doug, hey, how you doing?
Hey, I'm here. How are you guys doing tonight? Good?
Good. Yeah, good. So, Gary, is there a topic you wanted to discuss, or?
Well,
No.
I'm guessing about a week or two ago, you would have mentioned that the 10.51 is now on Warehouse 23.
Yes, I did. Which is good.
Okay.
I was expecting it 52 to be available like this week, but I'm assuming at least that was the indication that Steve Cole gave was that they were going to quickly turn out the 51, 52, and 53 relatively quickly. And obviously not have 54 available until 55 is available in your hard copy. In which case, then they'll make 54 available as an ebook.
Well, hopefully, 55 work will begin on that. But in the meantime, I think we're still waiting to see when the 2022 update to F&E Advanced Operations is released.
Agreed. I don't keep track of the F&E stuff as well as I really should. But it is what it is. Definitely, if there's a new SFB module, I'm there. I'm in there. Or new FedCom set of ship cards, I'm there. That will definitely catch me. Because I don't,
Well, back in the day, Advanced Operations introduced things like first generation X ships
I
and rules for, I believe, fast ships as well. But it also had rules for things like heavy war destroyers. So since then, a bunch of additional X ships and fast ships and heavy war destroyer missions and module like variants have been given their own dedicated counters in the recently released tactical operations product. So the current edition of Advanced Operations has been revised to account for all of those innovations since then.
Understood. I'm glad that they updated F&E to include some of the newer ships. Actually, that's one thing I. It's always a debate in my own mind, which is. Starfleet Warlord. I've had some submissions for additional ships with Starfleet Warlord. The big issue with Starfleet Warlord and adding new ships is that sometimes when you add a new ship, it's an ever so small tweak. And given that Starfleet Warlord, when it comes to their stats, it's very few and far between. You've got your hit points, you've got your basically your shield strength, your shield factor is SF. You've got your offensive potential and your defensive potential, and those are just numbers. And the problem is that in Starfleet Warlord, that if you have too many that are too close to one another, people like that, but the problem is it causes this issue. And that is in Starfleet Warlord, if you purchase the same ship twice in the same orders, there's a, if you buy two of the same ship in the same turn, you get a 10% penalty. Means that second ship is going to cost you 10% more. And then I think if you try to buy a third ship, that's without if you have any, I I think it's the event, special event, occurs. There's a special event that occurs that says, okay, wipe that out. Don't worry about it. But if you buy a third ship of the same type, then it goes up. That third ship costs 25% more than the original value and so forth. It keeps on, I think that's right, but it keeps going up. There's a penalty for that. So the idea of adding like variants and other ships are just a slight tweak is just pointless because it doesn't add anything to the game. And it's just, the only thing it adds to the game is the player's ability to actually sidestep the penalties to get a similar ship, get two of the same ship and avoid the 10% penalty because the BP, the actual EEPs, it costs economic points, which are pretty close to BPV, except for scouts and so forth, whatever. But those EEPs are probably going to be very similar also. So you reduce the amount of penalty you have to pay. So that's one that's always difficulty with Starfleet Warlord. That's why I really loathe to add any new ships into Starfleet Warlord versus, of course, Federation Empire, which you can, in my mind, I don't see things. I don't know the F&E rules well enough to say this for a fact, but I feel pretty confident in saying that I don't think F&E has the same penalty system that Starfleet Warlord does have for other ships. But usually I think those ships have to be available on a certain schedule. And that's the only limitation. Though obviously in Starfleet Warlord, they have the same kind of idea to a certain degree, in that they have the year of availability, and after that you can get that ship.
Well, speaking of year of introduction, YAS days, one thing that came up during tactical operations development process was all of the ships and variants that are in TAP, they have a year of service date no later than Y187. So basically, there are any ships that are available through to the mid to end point of the ISC classification, because that's the latest in the timeline scenario that F&E currently supports because of ISC war. So any variants or new ship holds that make their debut in, either in or after Y188, they'll have to wait until the Andromeda module is being worked on, which hopefully won't be too far in the future. Because there has been talk on the DDS about a new F&E countersheet being done, because every time that there's an older set of counters that runs out and that needs to be reprinted, one of three things happens. If the counters are in the current format, like for example, the counters for ISC War, they're done the current things. So they're more or less okay as is, unless there's like some glaring error that needs to be replaced. If they're in the previous format, then in the process of reformatting them for the current format, that basically adds space for about 50 odd counters or so, then that allows room for additional counters to be added in. But they're very specific, limitations in terms of what those counters can be, because they don't want to basically make people feel that they have to rebuy an old module to get new ships.
Right.
And thirdly, usually a countersheet print run is a good opportunity to throw in an entirely new countersheet. Mm-hmm. So
right, because they still have to pay for the cost and for that printing anyway. So
So if the idea is that there's at least one new module, and if that module can be Andro War, well and good. But the only thing would be, there's like two things to bear in mind that might be worth bearing in mind when that decision is made. And one is the Andromedans themselves, should they have separate counters for their satellite ships, or should the satellite ships be abstracted out into fighter factors? Mm-hmm. Apparently there's a split because Steve Cole wants to have them as fighter factors, but many of the staff want to have them as separate counters.
Wow.
The second thing in my mind now, this is a different story, is the current, because if you look at the IFC expansion, every counter that's in IFC War is just for the IFC. So you have to look elsewhere for the additional counters that are used by other empires. Basically, tactical operations includes, it includes a few IFC counters, but it also includes additional counters for everyone else in the Alpha Octant who is, that is currently supported in the game system. So you wouldn't necessarily, if you want to get the IFC to start off with, you get IFC War, and that's enough. So, but with Andro War, the question in my mind would be, should the Andromedans be the only empire that's in Andro War, or should any of the additional ships, and there's quite a lot of ships that aren't in FME that would be needed to fight out the Andromedan War, should they be in the same module, or should there be yet another, I guess you call it like a reinforcement module or a general module, if that makes sense, that those ships could should be in, so that the Andromedans have the Andro War module all to themselves?
As it, when it comes to the whole stop. Sorry, my cat is attacking me.
Getting eaten.
Yeah. Just the deadly zitting right here. Growl. Yeah. Aww. I was going to make one comment about the FNE and the Andromedans and having the satellite ships as count as just fighter factors. I can understand that to certain degrees, but there are, see, the big issue in my mind is the larger ones, like the Mamba, and specifically the Python, because the Python is one of those weird in-the-middle satellite ships, because it's one of those satellite ships that can be a satellite ship, you know, be actually brought into a mothership. But also, since it has a DizDev, it can also have, it can actually perform independent operations too. You know? I can understand for certain.
Well, the same is true for the same is true for the Reconnaissance Cobra, which is, it has one fewer TR beam to make room for a DizDev. So, but that's not even the end of it, because, oh, yes, you're right. On the one hand, there's the question about satellite ships that can move independently. So in theory, you'd think that they need to have their own counters. But then the other thing, too, is that if you look at, say, the Federation, in Fedon Empire, because, you know, historically they used the third way, like they didn't use fast patrol ships, there is basically like about four different types of fighter factor for the Federation. Maybe five, at least four. Mm-hmm. So there's one for standard size one fighters, like F-18s. There's ones for standard size two fighters, which is the F-101. Then there's a separate one, which is only for the Federation A-20 heavy size two attack fighter. And there's yet another one, which is only for the F-111. And the rules are such that you can't mix and match them. Like, you have to basically account for each of them separately. So you can't basically use F-111 counters to create A-20 counters. It doesn't work that way. You have to do the bookkeeping for them separately. So in theory, does that mean that you'd have to treat the satellite ships differently too? Like, you'd have to have one set of fighter factors for the smalls, like the Vipers, and one for the mediums and one for the large, so that you're not basically trying to create a Mamba out of medium-sized fighter counters, if that makes sense, or a Python, rather.
Right.
You know, trying to convert them out of the wrong fighter counter. So, personally, I'm much more in favor of just giving the satellite ships their own separate counters. But that's, you know, not what I think.
I think the separate counters thing is probably the way to go. If I recall correctly, aside from the fact that most of them can actually move independently as ships without needing the mothership, there was some, and I'm kind of, it's kind of a stretch, but I think there was some of their lore in that. They had a scenario about they lost their mothership and these other ships had to get home. or get to a rendezvous point or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think treating them as like fighters, fighter factors would be kind of like a bit off, considering the scale in SFB of how they're laid out and played. And I don't see justifying them down to abstracting them that much. That's just my thought on it.
I agree. Now,
I have a question that kind of piqued my mind when you mentioned that they are coming out with an Andromedan war module. Are they going to do like a strategic move thing for the motherships, where they can move a lot faster than everybody else, or are they just going to leave them with the standard FD movement stuff?
Well, they'd have to account for the RTF, but I think, I mean, because like, we'll have to wait and see what ADB have in mind for them. But I wonder if you might need to basically come up with some sort of double blind system where the Andromedan player has their own separate map where they mark where their satellite bases are, and then the Alpha Empires initially don't know where it is, and then later on, when they figure out how to find them, then they have to try to find them. But then you'd almost like, you know, if you can trust the Andromedan player, well, I'm good, but you might need like an umpire to make sure that when the Alpha Empires are finding those satellite bases, that they're in the right location. So it'll be a very different mindset compared to traditional F&E, where everything is on the table, so to speak, and you know where the IFC classification fleets are, or if it's a general war, you know where the Klingons and Romulans are, or except, of course, even cloaked Romulan counters are like here on the board somehow. So it's going to definitely take a different perspective to try to handle it properly.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And I think handling Andromedans at the F&E level, I think, is going to be quite a challenge. Just because, as you pointed out, the RTN network, the whole idea, I know previously the Andromedans, before the actual introduction of the Andromedan War, the Andromedans basically were just like a Roman monster. That's how they were used, you know. But it's just understandable, you know, that they came out of nowhere, they could attack you, you know, all of a sudden out of nowhere. And that's kind of, that was the whole idea, that had the whole, that feel of what it was like with the Andromedan War, you know, how they just show up and they attack people. But, you know, when you actually introduce Andromedans as a player empire, then you really have complications. As you pointed out, the whole idea of the RTN network and the setting up the RTN network. Because the question is, when it comes to the RTN network, I'm assuming that it's going to be player defined. Because it has to be player defined. Because if it's not player defined, the players, you know, the Galactics are going to have, they know where the RTN network is going to be set up. They know that from the rules. You know, it's like the whole idea of, you know, the D&D monsters, you know, that as soon as, because I'm not sure if either one of you have actually played Dungeons & Dragons. But
yes.
Oh, yeah. But you know how you I'm sure you've done it. I know I've done it. You've read through the monster manual for Dungeons and Dragons, and you find out these monsters. You find out their abilities. You find out their strengths, their weaknesses, how you attack them, and so forth. And you memorize these suckers when you're playing D&D. And so that, you know, when the GM comes, it's all you're facing. A monster looks like this. Oh, I know exactly what that is. And, you know, so you easily can defeat him. Well, that's the same thing with the RTN. If you have the RTN, that's always set up the same place, the same way every single game. You have to be player defined. They have to be, have ability to place it wherever they want to, and that's so they can place it, in unexpected places that another player would. Obviously, there's going to be optimum places to play it, and in some cases, you can't place it there. Why? As an Andromeda player, you can't place it there because if you place it in the best location, when it comes to the location for an RTN node, when it comes to attacking the different forces that you need to attack, if you do it that way every single time, they're going to know where you're going to be placing it every single time. So there's no
okay.
Scales back your ability to attack. So, yes, Doug.
I have an idea and a question. And the question that goes with the idea is, it's been a while since I've looked through the rules for F&E, but did they actually handle, I'm thinking they did in some way, the galactic survey ships, because if I remember my SFB lore a bit, they were used to help. They basically scouted out where the RTN was. So if they have an equivalent use for those in, say, in F&E, they could potentially do research to gather info on where the RTN is. And the RTN could be placed on the board at different places with restrictions, such as, not within the hexes of a capital area, not within this area, not in somebody else's system, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
But where it can't be attacked, each one of those RTN bases cannot be attacked until the particular Empire player gathers enough intel points to say, this one's over here and we can go attack the base, like doing a planetary assault. The benefit of the RTN itself might be, A, it's a big base for support and everything, and it may be where it sucks in economics off of the owning player for that region. And maybe it allows the player to say, okay, I'm going to use the RTN to place my guy within so many hexes anywhere without movement through the hexes, just like there you are because of the displacement technology. Okay, that was my whole thought. You're welcome. That makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, it makes perfect sense.
It's just one of those. It just kind of all popped in at once.
The only problem would be that would basically allow the Alpha Octant player to park a survey ship in that hex and just wait for the time where they know where the RTN is, and then they'll know where it is right away. Because if you have a double blind map where you keep the locations of the various satellite bases a secret from the Alpha player, then there'll be two different steps. There'll be step one is learning what the RTN is, which is historically what happened in Y-95, or over in the dark future, it didn't happen until Y-200. And then B, then you actually have to go out and find it. So it's, even though if you still got a whole bunch of hexes in your Empire's map, that you have to then, and also in the off-map areas, because the one big thing about the Andromedan War is that the off-map areas aren't safe anymore. So you'd have to basically come up with some way of accounting for the off-map as more than just like a generic off-map zone, so that A, the Andromedans can operate out there, and B, the Alpha Empires can unpack the RTN displaced out there. So I think that's also a thing that would be very different when it comes to how the Andro War would have to be played out, because I don't know whether or not when the first whole idea of the off-map zones was first invented for F&E, that there was any real thought about what would happen when the Andromedans get added to the game, and they're going to have to be out there attacking those planets that are in the off-map zone or bases or whatever, and how are you going to account for that? So, it'll probably be too much hassle to create entirely new hex maps just for the off-map zones. I'm sure there's probably some sort of intermediate abstraction that could be come up with to account for that. So.
Right. Yeah,
Just a quick thought on
well, it's actually.
marking a galactic survey ship in a specific spot. Perhaps in the interest of balance, they could play test it out, see how many counters it would take, but have multiple number of counters, like 1 through 10. The Andro player can put out all of them, and he writes down in the double, not necessarily in a double blind, but he writes down which one it actually is. And not only does your survey ship have to sit at that particular one long enough or do whatever method they're doing, because the survey ship, they might not be in the same hex. It might be next door to it. But it has to survive. It has to get the points. And then the player reveals which one it is. So if it's actually what they're looking for or not, and it takes time to do that, and you only get so many that are actually going to be, you know, or the scenario or the campaign. So if you have four bases overall for the network and you've got 12 counters, you either have to get lucky as the Empire player or you have to grind through all of them to find them. So that's just kind of a thought on having a deception level that doesn't necessarily need a referee. I mean, you can put that in a sealed envelope. We used to do that with Antietam. We would, you know, draw the chits, or when the random activation of the Union cores would come in, neither side would know it because we would just do it like in a blind method and seal the envelope and set it down. And every, you know, when it's time to start checking for that, you start drawing from it. You don't know. So there's ways. Do hidden stuff that doesn't necessarily need a referee, because I think adding a referee might add an extra level of difficulty for small set of gaming, small niche area of gaming.
Right.
Well, one other thing to bear in mind is you'd either have to, okay, so for argument's sake, let's say that somebody was using a double blind map to mark out where the RTN nodes were. You'd either have to have like pencil and rub it on an eraser or a dry erase marker, or have one that's just big enough to fit the counters on, because the Andromedans have the ability to relocate bases. Because historically, especially according to Module X1R, there's a write-up that they have that goes into the difficulties that was faced trying to get rid of the RTN. And one of the problems was that the ship that is searching for the node has to be by itself, because nearby ships will disturb the special sensors and ruin the readings. And so when the ship is doing the search, as soon as the base is discovered, the Andromedans know at once that the base has been picked up, has been detected. So the Andros basically have the choice. They can either zip in a mothership and pack up the base and move it to a different hex, which means that by the time the searching ship arrives to try to destroy it, it's gone. Or they could either leave the base to be attacked, which might sound good in theory, but if the Empire is basically being lured to destroy that base, then the Andromedans maybe have some other mischief that they're up to elsewhere. And so, and then on top of that, there's also the ability that the Andromedans will have to build new satellite bases and new modules, like if they want to construct a base station or battle station. So in a sense, the double blind map would have to be dynamic in and of itself, because you would have to allow Andromedan players to relocate bases and also to build new ones and position those, and also to upgrade bases. Like say if there's a very important base that they want to upgrade to a battle station. Or even on top of that, because in one of the more, recent is a relative term that comes with Starfleet battles, but there's a module that included the idea of Andromedan monitors. And so monitors, they have their displacement devices removed and they're stuffed in with other systems, so that you'd basically find them parked near an important Andro RTN node. Like, for example, the nodes that lead through the galactic barrier out into intergalactic space, those tend to have a monitor with some mobile weapon platforms parked beside them to defend them. But the thing is that for the Andromedan player, because they don't, those motherships, the monitors rather, don't have the placing them in the first place will be a challenge, because you'd almost have to basically come up with a rule to fly in a regular intruder or conquistador and then convert the mothership to the monitor variant on site. And then maybe you can repurpose that Dizdev like for a different ship or whatever, like put it into a satellite ship to create Python or something. And so I guess you'd have to have that on the double wide map too, because those monitors, they never use them to attack enemy planets or enemy ships or whatever. They only ever keep them in reserve. So you'd have to have those on the double wide map too, because you'd only be using the standard motherships and satellite ships to, you know, appear on the map to be able to like attack somebody. So I guess I suppose what you could even do is when you buy a standard box of basic set Federation and Empire, it gives you the paper maps of the eastern and western half of the Alpha Oxen. But a lot of the professional, like the really high-end players, don't use that because they order from ADB the large-scale maps, like the ones that are much bigger and have the lovely color lamination and the Empire's a different color and stuff. And they also have the boxes to show you the various planets that are in each capital hex and so forth. So in theory, what you could even do is you could give the paper maps to the Andromedan player and have them set them up on a separate table, or put like the kind of thing that you'd use for like an RPG, like a screen to kind of like stop the alpha players from peeking a look. And you could basically use the paper maps to represent the Andromedan setting up the RTM and maintaining the RTM, if that makes sense. And then you could basically have the Andromedan player, but players, because you could have more than one player, like team up to be the Andros. And whoever is representing the Andros in terms of the on-map stuff, they could be the ones to place the motherships and satellite ships that are attacking enemy planets or enemy ships or whatever. That might sound complicated, but I'm wondering if that's at least our way of going about it, if not necessarily the best way.
It makes sense. But one thing I just want to point out about the monitor ships, if I recall correctly, when it comes to like the satellite ships and ships without DizDev's device, they can still travel outside the RTN by strategic movement. They're slower, but they still travel the distance, basically, but it's not as fast.
We'll have to see about that, but I'm not sure, because I think that it's operational movement is what it's like, what they can do, but the operational movement is slower than for an Alpha Empire. But the strategic movement is tied directly to the displacement device. So, like, for example, an Alpha, like a Federation CA can move 6 hexes a turn using operational movements. It can go faster using strategic movements, but then the Federation only has so many strategic movement points that it can spend to account for that movement. So I guess with the Andromedans, you'd have to inverse that. So I think somebody was suggesting years ago that the Andromedans might be given unlimited strategic movement, but at the same time, maybe their ships can only move like 3 or 4 hexes without the DizDev. And that would be a big disadvantage in terms of, like, if the Alpha Empire succeed in clearing out all the RTN nodes within those 4 or 5 hexes, then it means that even if you do have a mothership with a DizDev attached, it's stranded, basically. So you basically have to move using operational movements to get close enough in the next turn to use it to escape by the RTN. But in the time that you're moving, you're vulnerable to being caught out by the Alpha Empires. So that's actually historically close to what happened when the RTN was being destroyed, because near the end, like in the run-up to Operation Unity, there were so few RTN nodes left that any Andro motherships or DizDev-equipped satellite ships that hadn't already escaped were on their own, basically. And so they either had to go underground or they'd get caught trying to make their way back to safe ground. So, but actually, in the, what I'm also thinking is, in terms before, because either way, doing the Andromedans for FNE is going to be a massive deal. But I think that there might be three test cases that could be worked up in order to get a sense about, at least at the tactical level, how the Andromedans work in a relatively open setup, so that you don't have to worry too much just yet about the implications of the RTN. For example, in module C3A, there is an SFB campaign, mini-campaign, that is all about the fall of Demorak, the capital of the Lyran Democratic Republic. And it has orders of battle drawn up for both the LDR as a defending empire and also the Andromedan forces that were used to subjugate it. So you could use those that campaign as a basis to be able to test out on the tactical level, at least, how you'd fight out the battle rounds using the incoming Andromedan motherships and satellite ships against a fixed number of defending LDR ships. So you'd be able to basically play out those rounds and get a sense of, like, you know, in terms of the balance, are the Andromedans working the way they should? Or if not, what needs to be changed in order to dial them in correctly?
Right.
And I guess the second option would, of course, be Operation Unity itself, because, like, Operation, even in FFB, Unity is relatively open in the sense that, well, abstract, I should say, because historically,
right,
when you get to the Magellanic Cloud, you'd have to use the Module C5 map, and you'd have to uncover, I mean, the local Magellanic resistance forces, they tell you where one of the two surviving star bases is, but even they aren't entirely sure about where the third one is, so you have to discover it. But in the original abstraction for Unity that was done before Module C existed, you basically just had a generic set of three links going to the LMC, and
right,
then you had just an abstraction to represent where the starbase would be. Because back then, there was only one Andromeda starbase. There wasn't any more than that.
Right, right.
So you could basically... now, of course, much as I would like to see a full FNE scale, updated version of the hex map, I'm not expecting that to happen.
Right. You're realistic on that, on that category.
But at the very least, there would probably have to be at least some sort of abstraction to basically show, okay, here's where the Andromedan places his starbase counters, and here's where he manages the ships coming in from Andromeda. And then these are the routes connecting to the Alpha Octant to travel to and from. And so by the time that you're doing Unity, you basically just you give the various Unity empires their respective orders of battle, and then it's open by the standards of the Andromedan War, because you've got, like, a fixed endpoint, you've got relatively fixed waypoints, and for the most part, you don't have to do the same kind of cat-and-mouse game that you have to do in the run-up to Unity. So I think that that would actually probably be a really good intermediate test in terms of, like, how well the Andromedans work, because you could start off by testing, like, the LDR situation, and then if that works, you could look at Unity and then see if that works, if the Andromedans are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And then if that works, then you could tackle a much bigger issue of how to unpack the broader ebb and flow of the invasion proper.
Actually, you bring up an excellent point, I think, which is with the FNE Andromedan War, how to handle the transition. That is the transition from, okay, we've completely destroyed the RTN network of the Andromedans. Now, together, as the Alpha Octant, we're going to go attack the Andromeda. We're going to go up to the LMC and we're going to destroy the star bases, you know, that are up there, you know. However, you know, following them back to the LMC or however, you know, I forget exactly how they figured out they need to go to lesser manage, you know, the LMC. I forget that part of the history. But still, you know, but the big point is, as I point out, which is that the transition, how do you handle that? You know, because during the Andromedan War, the Andromedans weren't the focus of it. They just happened to be an underground, basically they're a war underground, the main war that was still going on. I understand it was as the general war was kind of petering out, basically. But still that the general war was still going on.
No, the general war was over in Y-185, and then the IFC pacification started in spring Y-186, and the pacification was at its height at the eve of the Andromedan invasion. So most of the empires were on a peacetime level. So basically the Andros hit the IFC first, and then after they weakened them, they started turning on everyone else. But one thing to bear in mind is that, remember I just mentioned about the monitors?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways that they discovered the monitors was because in the process of clearing out the RTN, they were doing sweeps of the various map hexes along the Galactic Rim. And eventually they found three locations where the Andromedans had placed battle stations defended by monitors. And they could tell from the warp trails that were going through the galactic barrier that these were the three entry and exit points from the Milky Way to the routes heading over down to the LMC. So basically, once those bases were destroyed, the Alpha Empires were send ships to the galactic barrier themselves. And once they were on the outside, they picked up the emissions, like the warp traces, whatever.
Mm-hmm. That warp led trails, them yes.
To the three routes going to the LMC. So they could basically pick up the remnants, the warp traffic, actually, I could say, that basically went between the nodes, because there was so much traffic that the Andromedans were doing passing back and forth, that once you got through the far side of the barrier, they were able to pick up on it, and they knew that they led in the direction of the LMC from each of the three waypoints. So once that was known, then Operation Unity could be assembled to go through, set the same task forces through the barrier at each of those points, and then have them converge in the LMC after fighting their way through the various nodes in between.
Right.
But what you could also do is, one of the interesting things about Unity is in Module C3A, they go into more detail about the Darwin's dark future timeline, the one where the Darwin vanishes for 12 years. And in that timeline, the surviving Alpha Empires actually did try a similar, like a smaller scale version of Operation Unity. They called it Operation Co-Dominion. But that only had four empires involved. It was on two axes of advance. So they either never found the third axis, or they just didn't have the strength to tackle it at the same time. So in principle, once you have the abstraction worked out in terms of, like, here's the map that you use for Operation Unity, you can also use that same map to try to play out Co-Dominion. And you can actually see the difference, not just in terms of how much more powerful the Andromedans still are. Because the thing is that if only two of the routes are being attacked, then the third route is free for the Andromedans to send ships to and from the galaxy. And on top of that, in the alternate timeline, the Andromedans were able to deploy battleships and also the dissection beam variants from module C3A, like a devourer, on the way to attack the Alpha Empires. So you'd really be able to show just how much more of a challenge it was to even get to the LMC in the Ultimate timeline than it was for Unity in the what became the standard one.
Okay. Interesting.
But the only thing is that I don't know whether or not there'd actually be the opportunity to include the dissection beam variants in Andro War. Of course, I'd love to see them, but whether or not they'd be included in the story, because on the one hand, they were quote-unquote real, but they were only real in the Dark timeline. So would they have to wait for a follow-on product that was set only in the Dark future, or would there be enough room to factor them in Andro War as well?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I honestly don't know. Can you say hello? For those on video, can actually see my cat, who's currently laying on my shoulder. Yes, what is it, little goofball?
What's on? By the way, it's definitely a very exciting prospect to see. Actually, before we go any further, sorry to hug the conversation yet again. But
that's fine.
I was
mentioning. Hey, I like talking about the Andromedas. Come on, you know me.
Okay. Well, I was mentioning earlier that tactical operations only goes as far as Y-187. Mm-hmm. So that means that everything for the Alpha Empires that appears from Y-188 later still has to be done in counter form. And that's important for a couple of reasons, because for the one thing, when the Andromedans invaded the ISC, two big things happened to the ISC. One of them was the home shipyard began pumping out war classes, like the war cruiser and war destroyer, either by converting pre-existing ships or by building them from scratch. And you can see those if you have the Shapeways website that you can bring up on your web browser. You can that can help remind people what those ships look like, because some of those are actually they're available for the ISC on the Shapeways storefront as we speak. And what's also on Shapeways is before the invasion started, the ISC had a whole bunch of bases that they ran along the neutral zones. So from the edge of ISC space all the way to the border between the Lyrans and the Klingons and Hydrans. Just right up to the edge of Udar space. And so when the Andromedans attacked, they destroyed some of those bases. And the remainders were basically cut off from home. So they weren't able to be fully withdrawn back to the ISC. So instead, the surviving bases ended up having to coalesce into these cantonments. And they basically had to try to survive long enough so that later on they could be repatriated home. But while they were isolated, the ISC engineers came up with a way to convert some of their ships into system ships. And they're ones that basically, they have a large hull section welded onto the bottom. But what they don't get is additional warp power. So say, for example, if you've got a light cruiser that can go speed 31 ordinarily, when you weld the module onto that, the system cruiser gets a move cost of 1, but it still doesn't get any additional power. So now the ship can only go speed 25. So that is basically all those ships, both the war cruisers that would have been built at home, and also the system ships that were built, converted rather, out in the cantonments, as well as the fast blockade runners that were used to ferry spare parts to and from them. Those all need counters. And so that's just the ISC, because another thing that was missing in TAC Ops, because you might recall I was saying that tactical operations included a whole bunch of counters for mission variants of heavy war destroyers. So, for example, most empires have their fast patrol ship tender variant, HTW.
Right.
And the Federation have a variety of different, like they have the F-111 tender, they have a different F-111 tender that has only four F-111s and a pair of special sensors. And then they have an A-20 tender, and they have like F-101 and so on. So what have not yet been printed in counter form are any of the advanced technology HTWs that were in Module X1R and any of those variants. And this will be pretty important, especially for the Federation, because since the Federation never built PFs,
right,
they are not able to use heavy PF tenders to hunt the Andromedan RTMs the same way that, for example, the Romulans have the Sparrowhawk EX. So it's basically a Sparrowhawk with special sensors and a flotilla of fast patrol ships. And you can send that to try and destroy a satellite base. Now, the Feds don't have that option. But what they do have is you can take a Fed advanced technology heavy war destroyer and give it the same recon heavy carrier variant where you basically give it four F-111s and a pair of special sensors. And it's semi-good in terms of being able to go after RTM nodes. But that's called the Z variant in FNE terms. Like, it would be the HWXZ when it ever exists. So Federation players are going to need those, because even though you have the advanced technology collective survey cruisers to lead the charge in terms of hunting the RTM, Federation space is quite big, and especially if you factor in the off-map zones that they would have by then. So you're going to need a lot of ships to be able to overturn the RTM within Federation territory. So they alone are going to need a number of additional ships that are tailored to this mission. And so that basically goes back to the question. If you're adding in all of these additional ISC and Federation and I guess Klingon and Pazinti, because remember the Pazintis have the super space control ship Goliath, that would need a counter too. So are you basically overloading Andro War as a product in and of itself by putting it in with Andromeda mothership and possibly satellite ship counters? Or is it better to just split them off again and have a new module that's just to get the other empires up to speed and then let the Andros have their own module to themselves?
Well, in my mind, the question actually comes down to counter sheets. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because of how many counter sheets do you plan on having in the Andromeda War module, you know, in that box? I think that's gonna be part of the issue, in that they can't have, I don't think they could have just those ships as a separate module because of the counter sheets. And it seems small when it comes to FNE. Now, obviously, they could add it in a previous, in another module, and so bulk up that one. And in theory, you could cut back on like one sheet in the Andromeda War, but what's the point? I'm assuming that ADB has a certain number of sheets that they like to have in each module. You know, in other words, it keeps the weight the same, shipping costs the same, things like that. You know, production cost the same, or approximately the same, because obviously part of the production cost is going to be how many when you actually get a printed copy of the rules, how much does a printed copy of the rules costs? Because each page is going to cost them additional money. Because you have the paper, then you have the ink and all that kind of thing. But
I don't think that all FNE products are equal in terms of the number of counters they have. So, for example, IFC War comes with a lot of counters because they had the biggest fleet in the Alpha Octant at the time they were doing the pacification. And as I say, that's only just their peacetime ships. So all those wartime ships that they used for the Andro War aren't on there. So that one has, that's a particularly hefty module for a single Empire to get. But on the other hand, there were counter sheets that were done up for the minor empires, the LDR, the Sultorians, and the Liran Democratic Republic. And I'm fairly sure that they actually have a smaller number of modules, counter sheets rather. Or maybe it was because you're splitting it between three small empires rather than one big empire.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, that recent module that came out, Tactical Operations, if I recall correctly, it comes with four counter sheets. Three of them are copies of the same one, so you get multiples of whichever ships those are. And then the fourth one is you only get one at a time, and those are more obscure variants that historically only appear maybe once or twice in the timeline. So, I do believe that, if I recall correctly, there's a certain amount of flexibility in terms of dialing in how many counters you're going to need for a given empire. And because we'll also see that soon as well, because I believe they've actually already printed the counters for F&E Civil Wars. So that's going to be Republican Romulans, Rebel Lyrans, that sort of thing. And that module hasn't actually been released yet, but you can order the counter sheets as spare parts directly from the ABB shop. So it does get kind of weird sometimes in terms of the scheduling of the actual rule sets, or the updates for the rule sets rather, running on one track, and then the logic of printing the counter sheets on the other. So, because as we see in the case of Civil Wars, they had, because just in terms of like the necessity of reprinting old counter sheets, they pretty much had to throw Civil Wars and Tactical Operations into the same production run. And so Civil Wars, as I say, it has the actual physical components ready before it has the rule set that you can buy or download or whatever. So hopefully that won't be a factor when it comes to Andro War, but we don't. I mean, they'll probably take a lot of development time to get the rules right. But then the stakes are higher because, even just as simple as deciding, are you going to use dedicated counters for the satellite ships? If it's going to be a longer time to work out the rule book rather than choosing the counters, that's going to be a really big decision to make early in the development process, if that makes sense. So basically say, all right, we're going to go with fighter counters, or we're going to go with satellite ship counters. So it's, I'm not trying to panic or anything, because I'm sure it'll all work out in the end. But in the process of getting there, it'll be an interesting thing to watch out for. Because, of course, you know, there's F&E is not the only game that ADB works on. I mean, there's going to be demand for other development projects, like Captain's Log 55, and hopefully SFB Module X2 at some point, and things like you were talking before about, like, X-Ships Attack. Actually, they don't really, I don't know if they need counters or not, but they do need ADB development time, of course.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, understood.
Getting everything lined up will be an interesting thing to keep an eye for.
Understood. Yeah, I just want ADB to produce more products. Now, I understand that, you know, they've got a limited number of people, a limited amount of time that each person can work on things. And, you know, Steve Petrick just came back from an extended illness, and Lord knows illnesses have been, health issues have been, in the past 10 years, have been quite a challenge for ADB. Well, health and family issues, because in the past 15 years. Part of that, I think, was his, Steve Cole's brother's death, and and of course his own health issues. In that, and of course, now Steve Petrick's health issues. Which you want to give him a good Gibson slap on that one, because he was being smart about it, you know. Grumble, grumble. Hopefully he's learned his lesson and he'll take at least as good care of himself as he can, you know, given his current situation compared to what was many years ago. That was one thing that Gary, you missed out on, and if you were online, you would have missed out on anyway. I'm not sure if you watched YouTube video at all for last week, because last week was definitely a YouTube one because of all the pictures from the previous Origins that I was showing on screen. And I they were part of the YouTube video. You know, and when I think about Steve Petrick, I don't think about the latest picture of him, you know, being, you know, old and frail. I'm used to when I think about him, I picture the person that I knew like 15 years ago, you know, which is totally different person when it comes to the way he looks. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. We're getting younger.
Oh, don't remind me. Don't remind me, because I'm starting to feel it. I'm starting to feel it in my bones. You know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think with that we'll wrap this thing up for tonight. Obviously, we never got to the original topic, which, hey, it happens around here. This is not the first time, and sure, it will not be the last. And as I always have stated in the past, which is, I can announce the topic for tonight, but the topics are subject to change without notice. So, it is what it is. Anyhow.
Well, that's the Andromedans for you. The show can be expected.
Well, then, I'm sorry. Say that again one more time.
I'm saying that's the Andromedans for you. They show up when you least expect it.
Yes. Agreed. Yep. Well, Doug?
Yep.
You have a good night.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on. Plug. Gamer's a winner, etc.
Yep. Everyone go to gamersawinner.net. And you'll find him.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you have a good night. Gary, it's always a joy to have you around. You have a good night.
Thank you, and have a good night.
Okay, bye. So, the original topic went out the window. Of course, you guys didn't even realize they had an original topic, which was something other than this. But anyhow, great discussion about the Andromeda War and F&E and some of the interesting issues that will definitely ADB will have to resolve. And that I think of all the F&E modules that are currently out there, I think the Andromeda War is going to be the most challenging, the most interesting of how they figure out the issues that we've discussed tonight. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.